Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. Today, we are diving deeper into the dynamic between our two main characters, Saul and David. As we saw in our previous episode, it appears that their individual popularity seems to have an inverse relationship between the two of them. Saul's status in the eyes of his friends and family is falling apart, and David continues to win over the hearts of all of Israel. This naturally makes Saul very jealous of David, and the soap opera level of drama between them only intensifies.
So, despite his fear of him, Saul then attempts to have David marry his oldest daughter, Merib, with the caveat that David will fight all of his battles for him, right? So Saul's logic is that the Philistines can get rid of David for him. Now, David's initially confused by this because he's like, how could I possibly deserve to be the son-in-law to the king? But nonetheless, David and Merib don't actually end up together anyways, as she's given to someone else in marriage instead at the time when she was actually supposed to wed David. Not sure what happened there. So Saul's other daughter, Michal or Michal, loved David actually. And Saul saw this as a perfect opportunity to make David his son-in-law after the initial attempt failed. So Saul has his servants relay his plan to David, which David again shuts down out of respect that he has for the role of son-in-law to the king. And you know, taking into consideration his own humble family tree.
And I think that's a really interesting point because we see that this isn't a front of humility for right. David. He's actually really concerned about honoring and what would be dishonoring the king. And he rejects his offer multiple times, which demonstrates, you know, just what humble beginnings David came from and how undeserving he felt of that position of honor. He even says, "How can a poor man from a humble family afford the bride price for the daughter of a king?"
To which Saul responds by sending David a message that he will not require a price for the marriage of Michal or Michal. This is where it gets weird.
Yeah.
He will only require 100 foreskins of the Philistines.
Yikes.
Yeah. So Saul again is thinking, well, this is a great opportunity for David to fall at the hands of the Philistine and he can kind of keep his own hands clean.
Right.
So David agrees to Saul's proposition, and we're told that he obtains not 100, but 200 foreskins of the Philistines and then brings them to the king. Just very odd. But that's what Saul wanted. So once he has met his end of the bargain, David then marries Michal. And we're told that he has continued success against the Philistines and that Saul knew the Lord was with David. And so, of course, his fear of David continues to grow, and he sees David as his enemy continually.
Yeah, and that coupled with the fact that Michal genuinely, we're told, loved David, this just wasn't an arranged marriage, you know. This just made the situation even worse right. for Saul, as he knew killing David would prove to be a challenging task, both with Michal, who is now married to him and loves him, and his son Jonathan, who we already saw
knit souls. You know,
yeah, knit souls and give all his stuff basically to David to prove how connected they were. So, not too long after this, Saul tells his son Jonathan and all of his servants that they should kill David.
Yeah.
Which
clearly he's not aware of the oath that David and Jonathan had made earlier on.
Right, father of the year. So Jonathan goes and he tells David of his father's plans, you know, because he's his friend, and he tells him to hide himself. So Jonathan then goes to speak to his father and attempts to divert his anger towards David and expresses to him that David's an asset. You know, he's been a great asset to the kingdom and he's able to talk him down. So Saul does relent. And we are immediately just sent into another war. David was sent out to this war to fight the Philistines once again. And once again, we're told that he struck them all down. But I don't think this pleased Saul. as the harmful spirit once again, we're told, comes upon him. And while David is playing the lyre, Saul again, guess what he does? He hurls another spear at David.
This is like, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice.
Fool me a third time. This is the third spear.
I think he's, I messed it up. Fool me once, shame on you.
Yeah.
It's like, but they're both fools in this case.
Yeah, this is the third time he hurls a spear at David, and his spear hurling days are not over, as we'll see later on in the story. But David luckily evades Saul, and so the spear strikes the wall behind him, and Saul's not done. He sends messengers to David's house to watch him, and instead they're going to kill him in the morning, according to Saul's command.
Right, but Michal actually catches wind of this, and so she warns David, you know, she loves him, so she warns him to flee. So she lets David down through the window in their house, and he escapes. So then Michal stuffs the bed with an idol or some kind of image to resemble a body, and then puts goat hair around the top to resemble his hair. So when Saul's messengers look in, they see David, right, or something that resembles David, is lying down in bed. Michal tells them that he's sick and he can't get out of his bed, so the messengers return to Saul to deliver the update. Saul is obviously angered by this and then tells his messengers to go back and bring David in his bed in order to kill him if that's what it takes.
Yeah, and that just reminds me of like the classic move that kids try, you know, just stuff the bed with pillows, fake hair so they can sneak out at night and their parents don't notice when they peek in through the door. You know, you see in movies all the time.
Right.
But I mean, apparently it worked this time.
Yeah, in this case, it worked long enough for David to escape. So when the messengers come back to get David, they see it's not actually David in bed. And when Saul hears of this, Saul demands Michal to explain why she has betrayed him and let his enemy escape. Michal tries to use the line that, well, if she didn't, then David would have killed her.
Yeah, and I don't think Saul's buying that at all.
No. So David fled and went to Samuel in Samuel's hometown, Ramah, and explained to him all that Saul has done. So both Samuel and David went to live at Naoth within Ramah. And the word Naoth means dwellings, and it's actually speculated that this is where Samuel held his schooling for younger prophets.
Yeah, and so eventually the word gets around to Saul that David is there, so he sent messengers to take David and bring him back to be killed. And when the messengers arrive, the Spirit of God comes upon them, and they begin to prophesy. So Saul hears of this, and he sends more messengers, and, well, it happens again. So he sends more messengers, and once again, they are overcome by the Spirit of God and begin to prophesy before Samuel and David. So finally, Saul decides to go down himself, and when he does, he too begins to prophesy. But not only that, he also strips of all of his clothes and lays naked day and night.
Weird. So, and you might be remembering this proverb that was perpetuated throughout Saul's reign, where it says, is Saul also among the prophets? And you can see why that just keeps coming up.
Right. So David takes this opportunity to flee from Naoth in Ramah. And he, upon finding Jonathan, he asks him, you know, what have I done? Am I guilty of something? Why does your dad seek to kill me? To which Jonathan responds that it is not David's fault, and he's not certain that Saul aims to kill him, but that he'll make sure to warn David if he hears such. So David is not convinced by that, and he is very certain that Saul does aim to kill him. I mean, you throw a spear three times at someone, it's pretty clear what your intentions are.
It's a good thing he caught on.
Right. And so to prove this, David devises a plan to identify the state of Saul's heart. Basically, David normally attends a moon festival, and the moon festival occurs once a month following the new moon. And it was a 2-day long joyful ceremony in the king's palace with a lot of food, trumpets, and offerings to obtain peace and rest. However, David elects to not attend the moon festival for this month, and instead, he makes up the excuse that he has to go to Bethlehem for an annual family sacrifice. David actually just plans to hide in the field and wait until the festival is over so that he can gauge Saul's reaction to his absence to this important family meeting. So if Saul says it's fine and he doesn't take issue, then David is safe. But if he responds with anger,
not good.
Not good. So Jonathan promises to David that he will find out for him Saul's intention and that he will actually goes on to make a covenant with David's household, saying, "May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies." So Jonathan then tells David to go hide and that on the next day, David will know if it is safe for him to return based on the sign that he gives to him.
It's a good friend.
It is.
So the next day, Saul notices that David is gone, and Jonathan attempts to cover for him, of course, saying David is in Bethlehem and that he would like to join his family for sacrifices there. And as we can probably expect, Saul becomes very angry at this and tells Jonathan that while David lives, Jonathan's kingdom would never be established. And he asks Jonathan to bring David to him, probably more like commands him, so that he can kill him. And Jonathan obviously pushes back and asks, what has David even done to deserve death? But Saul is so mad with rage that he hurls a spear once again, but at this time at his own son, echoing what he had obviously already done to David, and just further demonstrates his willingness to kill even his own son to get his way.
Yeah. And obviously this made Jonathan very angry.
Yeah, right? Makes sense.
And so we're told that he arises and leaves Saul's presence, which is a smart move after someone throws a spear at you. And he then went to the field where he signaled to David the danger by shooting three arrows and using his instructions to the arrow boy as a code to communicate to David that he was to continue fleeing and to keep the arrow boy ignorant of their plans. So Jonathan eventually gets the arrow boy to go away so that he and David can have a farewell moment.
And we're told that David continues his journey as a fugitive and is helped along the way by Ahimelech, the priest at Nob. And from there, he further retreats to Gath, where he acts insane to not draw too much attention to himself as the officers of King Achish of Gath recognized David and knew it would be odd for him to be in their land, which is in Philistia. So David eventually makes his way all the way to a cave in Adullah, where he meets some of his family and eventually leaves his family safely in Moab. Now, at this point, David is instructed by a prophet to leave to the land of Judah.
Now, all of this is just an overview since David is just not the focus of this episode. However, since Saul is obsessed in trying to kill David, he is oftentimes reacting and just following David wherever that he hears that David has gone. So that's why we're paying attention to it.
And of course, you know, feel free to go back through 1 Samuel and read a little bit more in detail about what is going on as David is retreating all throughout Israel and through Philistia. So now Saul starts off by going to encounter Ahimelech, the priest, who, as you remember, assisted David and he had given him food and armor. And Saul asks him, why has he aided David? To which Ahimelech responds in confusion because, as he says, well, the king has no servant more loyal than David, who also is your son-in-law, by the way.
Right, yeah.
And Ahimelech makes it clear that he did nothing willingly against Saul, but Doeg the Edomite, first time we've heard about this guy, tells Saul that Ahimelech had inquired of the Lord and gave David provision.
And it's interesting because there's no signs in the text that Ahimelech ever actually inquired of the Lord.
Right. So naturally, like always, Saul loses his mind and decides that all of these priests in the whole city must be killed and destroyed. Initially, you know, even Saul's men refuse to lay a hand on the priests, but we're told that Doeg the Edomite carries out Saul's request.
And Doeg's presence in Nob was mentioned in chapter 21, verse 7, where he was called the Edomite three times in this part of the story. And it's probably there to point out that it was a foreigner who betrayed David and killed these priests, something that Saul's Israelite servants refused to do.
And remember, the Edomites were actually descendants of Esau.
Right. And so Saul treats Nob, this place with all of the priests, like some enemy city that has been devoted for destruction. So we see that Saul, you know, completely destroys the priest city, though he had failed to carry out those instructions to destroy the Amalekites previously. Instead, he is now destroying part of his own kingdom.
Now we're told that one priest, Abiathar, manages to escape the massacre at Nob. And he brings the ephod with him to go find David. And this actually marks the moment where the true priesthood and priestly council shifts from David to Saul. So Abiathar remains with David as his high priest until David's death. So after all of this, we see David just casually saves the city of Keilah from the hand of the Philistines. He's really good at this fighting thing. And while he is there, Abiathar, who was the only priest that had escaped Saul's massacre, arrives. And we're told, just like before, he brings the ephod with him. Now, interestingly, the word that David is in Keilah gets to Saul. And so when David learns of this, he inquires of the Lord through Abiathar and uses the ephod to determine if Saul will pursue him and if the men of Keilah would betray him. And unfortunately, the answer to both of these inquiries is sadly yes. And thus David and his men are forced to flee to the wilderness of Ziph.
Yeah, and now David and his men, we're told, are just hiding in the wilderness of Ziph with Saul and his 3,000 men still on their trail, so that Jonathan goes separately to find David. And when he does, he reassures him that he will be king and that Jonathan will make sure that his father does not find David. However, the people of the land of Ziph had other ideas, and they snitch on David to Saul. Saul is obviously very thankful as he thinks that he's finally going to have the opportunity he needs to kill David. And as Saul begins his pursuit, David and his men have moved to the wilderness of Maon. We are told that Saul begins to close in on David to the point where Saul and his men are on one side of a mountain while David and his men are on the other side. However, right at this moment, a messenger comes to Saul and says, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made raid against the land." So Saul has to return from pursuing David and goes up against the Philistines. Therefore, that place is called the Rock of Escape.
Seems appropriate.
Yeah.
So in the next portion of our narrative, we see two accounts of times when David is seemingly given the opportunity to take out Saul, but he chooses instead to spare Saul out of respect for the office of king and the Lord's anointing.
Yeah, and just like in the previous interaction, we see just a lot of divine providence here. In this first account specifically, we find that Saul has returned to his pursuit of David after dealing with the Philistines. And when he starts to continue this search for David in the wilderness of En Gedi, during his pursuit, Saul decides to rest inside a cave. Okay, and guess who is in the innermost part of that exact cave? You guessed it, David and his men. Yeah, so David's men quickly jump to the conclusion, surely the Lord has made this happen to give Saul into the hand of David. And David goes and cuts a corner of Saul's robe while he rests, but he is eventually heartstruck at what he's doing. And he tells the men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against them, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." So Saul eventually leaves the cave, and David follows suit and calls out to Saul to make it known to him that he desires to do him no harm, which is clear because he had the opportunity to do him harm, and he chose not to. And he proves this by showing Saul the corner of Saul's robe that he had. When he does this, Saul is humbled by David's sparing of his life, and he states, you know, who would spare their enemy if they had that opportunity? Even Saul understands that if he really wanted to kill me, he could have. So Saul then confesses that David will be king and asks David to swear that he will not cut off Saul's offspring after his death, to which David swears. And we are told that Saul just goes home.
And this is kind of, you know, an astonishing change of tone for Saul after being so aggressive and on David's tail, but we know that that actually doesn't last.
Right.
So after this encounter, we are briefly informed that Samuel has died. And we read of David's encounter with his future wife of Abigail as well. But we'll leave that part of the story for our series on David. So we find out that the Ziphites are once again snitching on David. And they tell Saul that he is now on the hill of Hakilah. So Saul and his 3,000 men once again begin their pursuit of David. And as we'll see, there are many parallels between this interaction to the previous sparing of Saul. So in this encounter, David spots Saul resting in his tent beside the hill of Hakilah. So he sends spies to confirm Saul's arrival. So after the spies come back, David himself goes one night and sees Saul and Abner, remember Saul's commander, sleeping inside a ring formed by sleeping soldiers. Now, David returns and asks Ahimelech and Abishai to go with him into the camp. Abishai actually agrees, and so they went to the army by night and find Saul resting with Abner, his commander, next to him, and they see his spear is stuck in the ground beside him. So Abishai again tells David, this is the opportunity to get rid of Saul. Pin him to the ground with its own spear right now. To which David actually similarly responds as he had prior, do not destroy him, for who can put his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish.
Spoiler alert, one of these does indeed happen.
Yes. So the Lord forbid, David continues, the Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. They instead take the spear and the jar of water and just leave. David then goes to the hill that is far away from the army camp and calls out to Abner. And once again, he gets his attention and he goes on to mock Abner for not protecting the king as he should have, since David was able to get so close enough to steal the king's spear and jar of water in Abner's presence. And so Saul once again recognizes and he says, he hears David's voice and he calls out to him to confirm that. And David replies, yeah, it's me again. And then again asks Saul, why do you continue to pursue me when I clearly have no ill towards you and I have no intentions of taking your life? So Saul again, you know, he confesses his sin to David and begs him to return home to Saul's presence. But we're told that Saul returns home and David goes his own way.
Yeah, and you can't really blame David for not trusting Saul or taking him at his word.
No. And of course, David's desperate to flee from Saul, and so desperate that he actually flees into the Philistine territory to avoid Saul's jurisdiction, you know, especially after the Ziphites have now ratted out his location twice.
Right, just snitching back and forth. So it is worth noting that there are a few psalms that were written explicitly during the time of this cat and mouse between David and Saul. Psalm 18 notes David's response when he was running from Saul. Psalm 52 is in response to Doeg the Edomite tattling on Ahimelech and David. Psalm 54 tells of the Ziphites tattling on David. And Psalm 57 and 142 is David's account of when he is in the cave with Saul. It's intriguing to be able to go back and forth and read the passages in the Psalms again with the details of our story in mind. We can really get to see how David responds to these exact scenarios when we read about them.
Yeah, I definitely encourage anyone who's listening, if you have the opportunity, to go back and write down these psalms and go and read them for yourself, because it's obviously very intriguing seeing David's very specific poetic response to these situations. So David actually hides out, as we were saying, with the Philistines for some time, and he's with the prince of Gath, just raiding cities left and right, and he's good at that, and really solidifying his status within Philistia as they prepare for battle against, once again, Israel.
Yeah, and with David now amongst the Philistines, Israel is preparing for battle again, and Saul, upon seeing the vast military presence of the Philistine army, we're told is greatly afraid.
And rightfully so.
Yeah, so this fear leads Saul to inquire of the Lord or want to inquire of the Lord, but the Lord does not answer him either by dreams, by Urim, or by prophets.
Now, remember that the Thummim is actually with David and the surviving priests from Agag, as he had brought the ephod with him when escaping from Nob.
Right, and it is interesting also to note that Samuel is now dead and that Saul had kicked the necromancers and mediums out of the land. But apparently we're told that there is still one left in the city of Endor. So Saul decides to go to Endor, which is just northeast of Jezreel, to speak to a medium. And he, of course, disguises himself because that'd be a pretty bad look for the king to violate his own command with two of his men. And so they go and they ask the medium to bring up Samuel the prophet so that he may speak to him. The medium is not aware at first that it is Saul and is of course very hesitant as she knows that the king Saul has kicked out all mediums, but Saul promises her that no harm will come to her. Once the woman sees Samuel though and realizes that it is Saul who made the request, she cries out and asks, "Why have you deceived me?" He again assures her that she is safe and asks her what she sees. She goes on to describe an old man wearing a robe.
Which seems like a pretty fair description for Samuel.
Yeah, kind of what you'd expect. So Saul says, that's the guy, and he inquires about the situation, hoping for Samuel's advice. Saul, however, does not get the good news from Samuel that he was expecting. Samuel makes it known to him that the Lord has already said he would tear the kingdom from his hand due to his disobedience with the Amalekites, and that he would give it to his neighbor, David. And just to rub salt in the wound, Samuel states that this Philistine attack will result in the death of him and his sons.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, Samuel communicates this word by saying, "Tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel also into the hand of the Philistines," which is pretty spooky, but I guess appropriate coming from a ghost.
Yeah, and at the sound of these words, we're told that Saul falls to the ground and is filled with fear and weak because he hadn't eaten all day. So the medium states, "I've done my duty now. Please eat so that you can have the strength to carry on." Basically, eat so you can leave. So Saul refuses, but between the medium and his men that came with him, Saul is convinced so that the woman, you know, butchers her fattened calf in the house and bakes some bread for dinner. And we're told that the same night, Saul and his men left to return to Jezreel, where the Israelite army was ready and set for battle.
Now, David never actually ends up fighting. Remember, he's with the Philistines at this point, just raiding cities left and right with the Prince of Gath. And he's never actually able to be part of the Philistine army because the Philistine commander remembers him as someone who had served Saul and therefore doesn't trust him to not betray them in battle.
Yeah, which is probably a good call considering all, you know, how David viewed the kingship and the Lord's anointed.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. So David was sent back to Ziklag, which is in the land of the Philistines, where David and his men and all their families had stayed while hiding from Saul.
Yeah, and there is a sad story that follows his return, but we're going to save all that for our character study through David.
Yeah. So even without David, the Philistines were able to overtake Saul, and all his sons, including Jonathan, were struck down. The battle continues, and Saul was gravely wounded by archers. He was wounded to such an extent that he actually asks his armor bearer to kill him to avoid being killed or mistreated by the Philistines. So the armor bearer does not out of fear, and Saul decides then he'll fall on his own sword. When the armor bearer sees this, he does the same thing, realizing that his king was now dead. So once the Israelites realized that their king was dead, the rest of them also fled to their towns, and the Philistines occupied much of Israel at this point. And so the very next day, the Philistines come to strip the slain, and they found Saul and his sons dead on Mount Gilboa. Mount Gilboa is just within Jezreel where this battle has taken place. And so the Philistines decided to cut off his head, strip his armor, and then sent messengers to carry the good news to the house of their idols and their people.
Yeah, and good emphasis there on the good news part, because here we see one of the first uses of the word basar, which means to bear tidings or good news in scripture. It is used once before in 1 Samuel 4 to refer to a messenger, but this context gives us a broader understanding of what the meaning of what the word gospel in the New Testament, which is euangelizio, I butchered that probably, but in the New Testament refers to, and that is an announcement or a proclamation that Yahweh reigns as king through Jesus, who has suffered and now been exalted as king.
Yeah, and so the Philistines didn't just stop there, though. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreth, and the Ashtoreth was the preeminent pagan goddess in the Bible, and they also pinned him and his sons to the wall of Beth Shan, which was a city within the tribe of Manasseh.
Yeah, and you can read more on Saul's death in 1 Chronicles 10. There are added details to David's reign in the following chapters as well.
Right. So now we are coming to a close with Saul's narrative, obviously. And so I want to draw our minds back to one of the stories we talked about in our first episode in the life of King Saul. One particular city within Israel was invaded by King Nahash the Ammonite. And after he had overpowered them, he told them that he would spare their lives if all of them cut out their right eye. Well, they naturally sent out messengers asking for help. And Saul, in response, cuts up a yoke of oxen and threatened all of Israel that if they didn't join, he would also kill their oxen. So the people of Israel, of course, rallied together and they defeat the Ammonites. That city that they saved was Jabesh Gilead. Hmm. And as we read at the end of 1 Samuel, we see that the valiant men of Jabesh Gilead marched into Beth Shan, which was just a little bit northwest of their city, and they took down Saul and his sons from the wall and returned to Jabesh, where they proceeded to burn the bodies and bury their bones under a tamarisk tree and fasted for 7 days. And this fasting for 7 days would have just been a more extreme sign of mourning for the people. Mm. And I remember reading this for the first time, and it really struck me and kind of left a lasting impact for me, realizing that Saul had quite the impression on the people of Jabesh Gilead. And although he had a very tumultuous and certainly self-destructive reign, he also delivered Israel from its surrounding enemies on several occasions and had established Israel as a successful, certainly somewhat successful militaristic nation. And as we'll see in the story of David, he too mourned for Saul,
yeah,
even after all of this had occurred between them.
Yeah, that's an awesome connection there from the previous narrative. And naturally, this concludes our time in the study of the life and reign of King Saul. There's a ton of really interesting stories and sub-narratives within Saul's life. And it really sets the stage for the natural downfall of monarchy for Israel throughout the Old Testament. We will be devoting one last episode to King Saul, where we will review the various aspects of his life and reflect on the message we can take from this story and apply it to our lives today.
We thank you for joining us through the story of King Saul, and we look forward to continuing with you all on our journey as we tell the stories of God's chosen people. Music, as always, is by Charles Spears, and mixing and editing by Victor Paez-Lemay. If you have any questions or suggestions, feel free to email us at stainedglassstoriespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks. Here is Stained Glass.